Today, both of them, though, are somewhat complex, and I'm sure a lot of people want to testify. We're going to start with Senate Bill 87. Sue, if you could, and Matt, if you don't mind grabbing me the sign-in sheet.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 87 authorizes the Public Utility Commission to modify the Electric Services Public Purpose Charge for cost-effective energy conservation, new market transformation, and above-market costs for new renewable energy resources. It limits the frequency and amount of change in public purpose charge, establishes a 10-year public purpose charge, eliminates the 10-year public purpose charge sunset of 2012 and establishes a new sunset date of March 1st, 2022. And for the record, Michael Mason from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs called to support the measure.
Good. All right, Chris? Chris from Empire Pacific Windows, I can't read your last name. Ware? Chris Ware? Come on up, Chris. And Jeremy Anderson, if you don't mind sharing the table together. Jeremy, you want to start?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, committee members, thanks for the opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. My name is Jeremy Anderson.
I'm sorry, hang on just a second. Commissioner Barr, you were here for this one, weren't you, 87? And you're all set up and ready to go? No, I think I'd like to start with the overview. I'm sorry, I just didn't have you on the list, but obviously you're here for this. So if you guys don't mind, I'm going to have you sit back down so we can get an overview from the PUC first, and then we'll start with the two of you. So, yeah, Commissioner, please come on up.
Good afternoon.
Just a minute.
No, go right ahead.
And I thought we had it all set up and ready to go. Mr. Chair, while Lori's giving this thing up, I can go ahead and start. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lee Beyer. I'm the chair of the Oregon. Right. It's not working?
That's all right. Just talk loud. We'll follow along.
I'm the chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I have with me Dr. Sparling, who is the director of our utility regulation program. He gets all the tough questions, if there are any. Mr. Chair, we're here today to talk about Senate Bill 87, which I believe is a simple bill, but we'll see. What it deals with, Mr. Chair, is it deals with a couple of changes to our public purpose program. It does a couple of things. One, it extends to 2012 the public purpose charge sunset for, It extends from 2012 the public purpose charge for 10 years to ensure the continuity of funding to these projects and conservation projects. And primarily they're large projects that we'd have to stop doing with the current one in about a year or so. Secondly, it provides flexibility for the commission to adjust the public purpose charge by up to 1% every 2 years, not to exceed 5%. And that adjustment would be both ways, but to be honest with you, we're thinking more up rather than down at this point. And I'll get into why that makes sense. And I guess the last piece that I would say is the other thing that it does is it makes clear that the funding for the mandated legislative reports in the bill, currently they have to be done every 2 years, and they're done by an independent contractor that responds directly to the legislature. Costs about $75,000 per report to have these done, and this would make it clear that we could contract that, or that we could charge that against the public purpose fund. So fairly clear ideas, more confusing than that, but what I'd like to do, Mr. Chair, is just kind of walk you through why I think this makes sense. And so what I'm going to, I have a very brief slideshow that I want to kind of walk us through, and essentially the issue is, why should you be interested as a public policy in investing in energy conservation or energy efficiency? Start off with just give you an idea about the demand. The chart that's up there shows the range of what's likely going to happen, and this is throughout the region put out by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. You can see that we're looking at an increase in thousands of megawatts, and this is if nothing happens. This next slide drops it down into Oregon. The public purpose charge, as you are aware, is applied against the ratepayers for Pacific Core and PGE. This is directly from their staff in what we call our integrated resource plan. That's where they project how much resource growth they think they're going to face in the coming years and what it's going to look like. And again, as you can see on that, it's the trend is upward. This is just a little better in a more numeric fashion for you. It shows what it looks like for the two companies together. And as you can see, over the period of time, we're looking at adding literally thousands of megawatts of energy. So what do we do about that? Well, there's only three options that you can really realistically look at in terms of meeting that growth. You can go out to the market if you're a utility and buy on the market to get that power. You can build new generation resources, or you can try to obtain conservation. That's to cut the load growth down. That's the options that you have. Well, going to the market has its own problems. What this chart will show you is the blue line is actually over the last 4 years, tells you how that's bounced around. The purple line is the forecast that they put there. I think the lesson to be learned for this one is that it's more expensive, and the trend line is up, not down. So that's the market solution. The other thing is you can build on new resources, and the two that you hear the most about are coal or gas. And if you're looking in the comparison that I'm using today is a 300-megawatt plant, which is a moderate a small-sized plant if you're looking at that, and that number specifically, the 300 megawatts, is the goal that we had through the public purpose charge to obtain in conservation. So the way to look at it is you can either conserve 300 megawatts or you can build them. I think the reality is we're going to do both, a little bit of each. So that's the cost, and I should go back and say that one of the things to keep in mind when you do this is when you build a plant, day one, that goes into rates. So you not only have the capital cost, but you'll also have some operating costs with that. When you're building a coal or a gas plant, one of the things that goes along with that is the operating costs, and you have certain risks that go with that. You have the risk of what's fuel going to cost. Now, we've seen that more recently with natural gas. When I started on the commission in 2001, the price for natural gas was about $1.50 to $2 a unit. In 2001, 2002, that number got as high as $17 a unit. Right now, it's bouncing around $7 or $8 a unit. So you can see, as your price goes up like that, that's the primary cost of running a generator, is the cost of that. Coal, likewise, is by far cheaper, but the unknown on coal, and something that you're reading a lot in the papers now, is the carbon side of that, the carbon capture. For each dollar of a carbon tax, if we had one. For example, most of Europe has a $20 a ton carbon cap tax. That's what's being talked about in Congress. Now, for each dollar of tax that you have, dollar per ton, that will increase the cost per megawatt a little less than a dollar. So you have a pretty close correlation if we get into that point. So those are the risk factors that go with that, on top of the capital costs. The other option, obviously, is renewables, which, again, this committee is going to be having a good discussion of. But, again, you can see that renewables don't come cheap either. Current pricing on that, a 300-megawatt wind farm is going to run you about $450 million at current prices. The good side of wind is that once you got it in there, you don't have a fuel cost, so you don't have those fuel risks. The problem you do have is it's intermittent, meaning the wind doesn't blow all the time, so you have to deal with that, and you have to have some backup. Solar, likewise, is there. It's a resource, but, again, it's very expensive. So There are other options we have out there that you're talking about or will be talking about, wave and biofuel and our biomass and some of those. But again, those costs are on the high end, and so you have those. And you have some fuel issues with that. Well, conservation measures, the real issue, the real point of this is to say that there is a lower cost with less risk to doing conservation than bringing on new generation. And that's the point of that. As we look at it, we've had a couple of studies that have been done. The council, the Power Planning Council did one, and we funded one through the public purpose charge that looked just at PGE and PacifiCorp. And what we found is that we can get to that 300 megawatt and maybe beyond that. But the point of this slide, I'd focus you on the gap, is with CURP funding, we can't get all the way there. We could get the equivalent of almost another power plant if we had a little more money invested in this. So it's doable, is what I'm trying to say there. There's cost effectively you can get to there. And here's a comparison. If you're looking at ways to get that 150 additional megawatts, again, if you're looking at coal, you're looking at spending, in the end, you're looking at about 3 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Gas, 4 to 7. Again, most of this is going to depend on your capitalization cost and fuel. And conservation is under 4. In fact, most of our conservation that we've looked at has been running so far at about a penny and a half a kilowatt hour. So I think that, you know, compared to the option, it looks good. So how have we been doing? Well, this is a chart I wanted to show you. This is over since 1978. The region has been investing in conservation, but very sporadically. The way we used to do it is the legislature required that the utilities invest as part of their funds into that, and it capitalized the projects and recover them in rates. As you can see, it was up and down, up and down, up and down, which is why the legislature, as part of 1149, established the public purpose fund to try and get a little more consistency. One of the things that, because I've heard a lot about this, and I just wanted to spend a minute talking about the energy trust and give you a couple of slants on this. Some people have wondered, are we getting our bang for the buck from the energy trust? And I'm going to just tell you that there's a couple of people who have talked about that nationally, and you can see some of the leaders from Vermont and Wisconsin have commented that they think the energy trust is one of the best programs in this sector of the business in the United States. There's a lot of people that have come to look at it. This is just a comparison of the costs in terms of what are other utilities doing compared to what we've been able to get for Oregon through the trust. And as you can see, the purple, which is the energy trust, is lower than the others. We've been getting a good buy out of them compared to everybody else. Just another view of that, the region, the Northwest Power Council, had set as part of their power plans, they always set a target for what each utility should be trying to get in terms of their goals. And as you can see here, the first bar, which is the trust, has been doing a good job. They've been exceeding their target, and some of the others have not been quite as successful. Again, just some others, PGE and Bonneville's comments on the staff and on the trust, which, again, I think is just to reinforce the fact that those who are in the business and understand it think the structure we got is working well. Just to give you a sense of what we've been able to do, the trust has been in effect since 2002 and really very strong. You know, we had a couple of years, just like any business, getting up and going. But I think they've done a good job. We've been able to help over 95,000, you know, customers meet their needs. And you can see the list here, the commercial buildings, I mean, the numbers are in the thousands of people who have been able to hit. I think it's a pretty impressive number. This last chart here really has to deal with where are we going in terms of the potential. And the difference is the blue line suggests what we can get with existing money, and the red line is if we had another penny or two, what could we get? Could we get the rest? So that's essentially a very quick overview, and the message that I'd like to focus on, or ask you to focus on, as a public policy, is there are a couple things we know for sure. We know that the demand in the region will continue to grow, and the demand in PGE and PacifiCorp will continue to grow. We know that we have to meet that. We're going to add some generation. But the question is how much and how fast will you see rates go up? the conservation, without a doubt, is the cheapest way to meet part of that energy need. And I think the way that I would like to suggest that you should think about that, as we do, is we look at conservation as we would at any other generator plant. And we do a least cost study and say, what's the least cost way to meet the demand? There are other arguments that you'll probably hear from people about, you know, should you spend money, you know, more on low-income weatherization or more on industrials or something like that. But our perspective on that is we don't focus so much on who the end user is. People who've heard me talk about this a lot have heard me use the analogy of the low-hanging fruit. I think I'm looking at it from my job working for the ratepayers is what's the cheapest way to work your way up that tree to meet the energy needs of all ratepayers. And that's the focus that we have on it. And that's why we bought Senate Bill 87 to you. We think this is a good deal for ratepayers and will save them money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lee, I guess my first question would be, if conservation is really, truly one half the cost of generation, why isn't industry doing only that instead of trying to do it? And why aren't power companies and co-ops and everybody else, why are they even thinking about generation? Why aren't they just strictly pouring all their money into conservation?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think there's a couple of answers to that. I think one is just a straight-up business answer. People who are in business focus, as you do, on what you do and the products you're selling. And one of the reasons I supported the Energy Trust early on when I got to know more about it was the fact that trying to encourage a good business person to sell less of their product is usually not a very successful strategy. They make money by selling power. That's one part of it. I think the other part is, from a business perspective, and we went through this on the first PG rate case that I was involved in 2001, I asked people how much, and these, we mainly had industrial business customers come up, how much of your business cost our energy? And the average person, we're talking about 1-3%. We had some industries, the large ones that you would expect, paper companies, semiconductors, that were up above 10%. But if I came to you in your business and said, let's talk about 1% cost that you might be able to control, how much energy, or that's probably the poor choice of words, how much attention are you going to pay to that versus other things that you're going to get more? And one of the issues that I'm familiar with from my background is you've got a limited amount of capital on an annual basis that you can spend in your business. I mean, every business is faced with that. If you're looking at that, are you going to spend it on something that might save you a little bit on a small percentage of your operating costs? Are you going to use it on something that you think is going to increase your production and get your products out there and sell more products? My guess is that most businesses are not going to be focused on the 1 or 2% items, at least I wouldn't be when I was looking at that stuff. You're going to focus on what's going to generate you the most profit, even though it would be nice to get that. I think that's the answer to part of that.
Okay, I guess let me ask you a different way then, or from a different perspective. If conservation is half the cost of generation, why aren't you as a PUC, when a rate case is coming for you, saying, denying them and saying, no, you get a better bang for the buck for me as a consumer by requiring the utility to go out and do conservation rather than generation?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, under current law, 1149, utilities, when we passed this, were the commission's ability to require them to do that was removed.
I knew I voted against that bill for a few reasons.
We'll give you a chance to rectify that this session.
Oh, don't worry. I'm not voting for this one either.
You have anything else?
Not right now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer and I had those discussions in the past.
I'm sure you have.
Mr. Chair,
Bates.
And not to bring up old wounds that have still not healed, I also was opposed to that bill and fought up my first for a session up here and still think it was a terrible mistake, but we won't go there. I want to follow up on Senator Byer's comments. I mean, is there some reason that we can't reinstitute that? Conservation appears to be the cheapest and best way to go here. My numbers, I may have this wrong, you know, you're going to get where you need to get to with about a third of the way with Senate Bill 87, where you think you need to be by 2012. If you had the authority to force more conservation, would that be helpful to you? Could you do it?
I'm going to let Dr. Sparling help me with that one, because he has more experience in this than I do.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee Sparling. I'm director of the utility program at the Public Utility Commission. In response to your question, Senator Bates, there are a couple things. First of all, the amount of conservation out there is limited. Some of the information you saw in those charts showed the conservation potential going up to a cost as high as 5.5 cents a kilowatt hour. You can spend more and you can do more, but as you go, you're going to have fewer homes to insulate, fewer businesses to make more efficient. So there is a limited amount. But I also want to follow up on what Chairman Byer said a few minutes ago about the restrictions that are already in Senate Bill 1149. Our counsel from the Department of Justice advises that we don't have any authority to allow the utilities, any clear authority to allow the utilities to include any more in rates to fund more conservation activities. It's also unclear that we have any authority to adjust the public purpose charge in order to collect more funds right now under Senate Bill 1149. So at this point, we don't have any tools to require the utilities or even allow them to spend more for conservation, even if there's more cost-effective measures out there, as Chairman Byer's presentation has indicated.
Follow-up?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
That's the question I asked you. If we gave you that authority, would it be helpful to you, and could you get more from conservation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bates, this bill is our approach to getting more funding for getting that conservation. As a general matter, the Commission does not have the authority for any type of resource to require the utilities to acquire it. The Commission's real authority is with respect to authorizing rates that allow costs to be recovered. And what we're looking for here in Senate Bill 87 is one way of getting increased funding, and that's through some ability to increase the public purpose charge and direct it for those purposes if, in fact, there's some showing, as preliminary indications are, that there's more cost-effective conservation to be acquired.
Mr. Chair, if I might jump in, there's a common misunderstanding about how we do things. I had it when I was in the legislature. There's a sense that the Commission has discretion to tell a utility that they can't build a plant or can't do this. Technically, that's not true. What we can do is we can tell them that whatever they did may not have been prudent and not allow them to recover some of the cost. I mean, that's kind of the control we have, is what amount of money we will put into rates, not telling them. The utilities are private companies. They get to manage their business. We just get to decide what fairly they can charge customers for. That's one. The other piece is, frankly, the way the conservation used to be done, the utilities would invest, however sporadically, they would invest, and then they would capitalize the cost. So in terms of cost to the ratepayers, I mean, that's a fair way for them to do. That's what they would do with a utility plant. But in terms of doing that, you're getting the cost of the project, the cost of the financing, plus a return on investment that's legitimate for the utility to get. So when you roll that all together, that way of getting at conservation is more expensive than using the public purpose charge. Same thing. I mean, in the end, who pays all this stuff is the ratepayers. That's who pays it. And you're looking at what's the cheapest way to get a better deal for the ratepayers. And my opinion, having worked on those slides, is this is the cheapest way to serve ratepayers.
Chair Byer, on that note, I'm going to let you two off the hook, because we will end the committee at 4:30 today. And when I, and thank you very much
thank
for being
much.
Here and for starting off the discussion. When I had the two gentlemen come up to start with, I was looking at the first of a two-page sheet, and we have a lot of people to testify on this bill, and we've got one other bill, too. So I'm going to call you up two or three at a time, and if you could, try and limit your testimony to 3 minutes or so, just so we can make sure that everybody gets a chance today. And we'll start with three, Brad Van Cleave, Myron Burr, and Julie Brandeis. I thought for sure you were going to take a shot at that question one more time.
No. I can see that we're going to go round and round and round.
It's a tough question for them. I don't know that they wanted you to have that authority. Mr. Van Cleave, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Brad Van Cleave, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. ICNU is a nonprofit trade association that represents the interests of large electric users in the Pacific Northwest. We're here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 87. I have submitted written testimony, or I will be submitting it momentarily. Thank you. And I will not repeat everything that I said in my testimony, but I urge you to take a look at it. I was one of the original drafters of Senate Bill 1149. that there's some important history that I put in my testimony about what the purpose of the public purpose charge is and what the intent of the legislature was. What I would like to touch on are the key reasons that ICNU believes that you should reject this bill. And first is that it violates the bargain that was struck in Senate Bill 1149. That legislation was developed by a coalition that included almost all the stakeholders, and it included some very important protections for large customers, three in specific. First, large customers were given the ability to self-direct a portion of the public purpose charge. Second, the OPUC was prohibited from raising the public purpose charge above 3% for customers with loads greater than one average megawatt. And to give you an idea how many of these customers there are, for PGE, which has about 775,000 customers, there are only 180 above one average megawatt. And there's a little bit of a misconception about the PUC's ability to raise the public purpose charge. What current law says in ORS 757-612-2F is that the commission can establish a different charge from the 3% for any class of customer except for customers larger than one average megawatt, and their public purpose charge cannot exceed 3%. So really this bill is aimed at, for PGE, for example, the 150 largest users, because the commission can already change the public purpose charge for everyone else. The second reason that this bill should be rejected is that the public purpose charge on its own has increased dramatically the amount of revenue that it's collected since it went into effect in 2002. It was originally envisioned that it would collect about $40 million a year, and in 2007, it is expected to collect almost $70 million. So as a result, Oregonians are already spending a lot more on public purposes than was originally intended, and this amount is growing every year. Third, the public purpose charge is accomplishing its purpose. There's been substantial investment in conservation and new renewables, and in my testimony, I note a number of new wind projects that both PG and PacifiCorp are pursuing. They have under development 400 megawatts of wind projects at a capital cost of over $700 million. So we're already spending more money, and we are already making a lot of accomplishments. Fourth, we think that it's premature, without compelling evidence, to change the 10-year plan that was put in place in Senate Bill 1149. It was provided that there would be a report in 2011 to the legislature in order to make the decision of whether to extend the public purpose charge or not. So this issue can be addressed in the next legislature. It doesn't have to be addressed in this one, and we're sure that the legislature will have a lot better information available at that time. And finally, Oregon already has high electric rates, especially PGE, and raising the public purpose charge from 3% to 5% will likely increase those rates, especially in the short term. And it's hard for larger businesses to compete now, and this will only make the problem worse. In summary, we urge you to preserve the bargain that was struck in Senate Bill 1149. The public purpose charge is working properly, and future legislatures will have adequate opportunity to address whether to extend the public purpose charge when it expires in 2012. Thank you.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Myron Burr. I'm with Celtronic Corporation. We are a large manufacturer employing about 1,000 people in the Portland area. We're very concerned about the impact this bill would have on more than 40 major Oregon employers. Brad talked about companies in the PGE service territory that would be impacted, something like 180, although only 40 of those have elected to be self-direct. And those people would be, those 40 large employers would be the ones that would be directly impacted by this bill. We strongly believe there's a better way to approach or improve the public purpose charge program, and we'll get into that in just a moment. The problem as we see it is that Celtronic, like many other Oregon businesses, is faced with the challenge of globalized competition. To make this challenge even more difficult, we've encountered a 42% increase in electric rates over the past 5 years. With that, when those rates go up, the public purpose charge rate also goes up, not the rate, but the actual amount, because it's tied to the electric bill. So public purpose charge funding is going up, just as Brad mentioned. It's going up because of increased electricity rates, but also because of the expanding economy. As the economy grows and more electricity is used, then public purpose charge funding goes up as well. So there's two natural increase mechanisms already built into that program. In our business, we're seeing the price for our products go down every year. Okay. So your prices are going down, but the costs are going up. We're caught in this cost-price squeeze. It makes it very difficult to be profitable. And I had the unfortunate experience of witnessing a company that was in this situation a few years ago in Tualatin, a plywood manufacturer, lay off scores of Oregon workers because they didn't have any control over some of their costs like these, and they couldn't control the prices for their products. So, you know, what the ultimate fatality is Oregon businesses and those workers when this happens. Regarding Oregon's competitiveness, Celtronic recently decided not to build a $1 billion facility in Oregon. They are building it in Asia. While there are many likely reasons for this decision, my own personal opinion is that it's because of the cost of doing business in Oregon. It's higher than other countries. And we have an opportunity here to keep those costs lower by changing this bill. Lately, I've been thinking about a few questions, things like why companies decide not to locate here in Portland. Why are large employers not coming to Oregon? Freightliner's going to lay off 800 employees. We have one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation. It's the worst, one of the worst in the nation. Why is that? You know, these are important questions because what we're witnessing is an eroding manufacturing and employment base. These jobs are going overseas. These Oregon jobs are going overseas. Oregon businesses are burdened by a multitude of factors, including high energy prices. And this bill will only serve to adversely impact these large Oregon employers. They cannot take any more costs. So the solution, as we see it, is to focus on those most cost-effective resources that Chairman Beyer described, conservation, or as we like to call it, energy efficiency. Industrial conservation is one of the least expensive. It's about 70% cheaper than wind resources. It's also very clean. It's pollution reducing, in fact. One of our recent projects not only saved 1.9 million kilowatt hours of electricity per year, but also 1,800 tons of greenhouse gases per year. And what does that mean? Those are numbers, big numbers. What do those mean? 1.9 million kilowatt hours a year is about how much electricity 174 homes would use. 1,800 tons of greenhouse gases is about what 360 cars emit per year. So they're significant. Just going through this quickly, I'll skip a couple things here because I think some of that was covered by Chairman Beyer very well, in fact. What I will point out, though, is one of the items that we are looking at is a way to improve this bill would be if we could remove the limitation that self-directs have now, these large employers in Oregon, large businesses use over 1 megawatt. If you can remove that limitation of only spending 56.7% on conservation projects, allow them to spend 100% of their public purpose funding, they would have opportunities to conserve more electricity and then be more competitive in the marketplace. So that's what we would propose. It would help preserve Oregon jobs. It would be better for the environment to promote this conservation. So that's how we would propose looking at this bill. Do not increase it for the self-directs, the public purpose charge, and allow them to take the existing funding and use it more cost-effectively than it currently is. Use the current dollars we have and use them more cost-effectively. If I might just address one of the questions that was brought up earlier, I'll hazard an answer to Senator Beyer's question about why companies do not go after these cheap energy resources. We are looking at a number of these big projects, but they're very expensive. We've got engineers dedicated looking at very big energy conservation projects, projects that cost on the order of $500,000 to $1 million. But there's a capital constraint. That money is not easy to come up with. However, if we had more of this public purpose funding, in other words, we had, instead of 56.7%, we had 100% of what we pay, that would help leverage more of the capital that is available. The other way to approach this, and we think it's a very good way to do it, is to look at the BETCY program, the Business Energy Tax Credit Program. Currently, energy conservation projects are allowed a 35% tax credit. If that were increased to 40, 45, 50%, like we're talking about for renewables, that would also be a good tool to encourage the acquisition of these resources that Chairman Beyer talked about. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries, and along with Brad, I worked on the original legislation that put in place the public purpose charge, and I clearly remember talking to Senator Bates, Senator Atkinson, and Senator Beyer about this legislation. So I wanted to, I handed out this piece. This is a piece we did for the AOI Board of Directors. And we did it as a way to sum up where the business community that we represent at AOI, what the position is on the increase of the public purpose charge. Further, we tried to give a little background, and I have done everything I possibly could to make sure these numbers and the information is accurate. I want to point out a couple of things. The first and foremost, I think one thing that the legislature may not recognize is that natural gas companies, not through any legislation, but natural gas companies do have an agreement with the PUC to put money into the trust as well. So the energy trust is not only getting money from the public purpose charge that is in statute. There's also natural gas money flowing in for commercial and residential customers only. And I think that's just important in terms of customers, business customers are not just paying in terms of electricity cost, at least commercial business customers. They're also paying in terms of natural gas. Excuse me. We have supported the public purpose charge. As many of you know, I lobbied in favor of the public purpose charge on behalf of our AOI members. This week I've been working with Mr. Burr and trying to encourage the expansion of the business energy tax credit in terms of conservation, because we believe that is an incentive for the business community to do the right thing. And we clearly agree that conservation is a valuable resource. Nevertheless, our board feels that the trust has, you know, really only been operating for a very short time. It only really started collecting monies in 2002. It is a very young organization. It is an organization that we have been involved with a great deal. AOI has had AOI and ICNU has had both have had members on the board. Keep in mind, this is a self-appointing board. The legislature has no authority over this. The commission has authority over this, but I think the concern that the legislature may want to consider is that our members feel that the public purpose charge is similar to a tax. It's a tax we support. It's similar to one. It's not called one, and you should have the authority over that. And by turning this portion of the industrial customers over to the commission, then I think you've given up that authority altogether. And I think that's an important concern that our members have. And that's not to say that the trust hasn't been doing a great job or a good job or a decent job. And I think you saw the quotes that Chairman Beyer provided, and I appreciate that. If you go to our website, you'll also see a list of concerns that we have been very vocal and very upfront with the trust about. And again, it's a young organization. They deserve to have growing pains, but this is not the time to expand their authority. Another point that we'd like to make is that about $11 million, I think, is collected. I'm checking my numbers. Yeah, is collected for renewable resources to buy down the above market cost of renewables. And in discussion of what the RPS proposal will look like at the end of the session, we have no idea if that $11 million counts within the what we are being told is a cost cap or not. Most people have told us that would never count as part of the cost cap. So we have a bit of uncertainty about how much money will be moving into renewables from, one, the public purpose charge, as well as from any RPS proposal that should come through this session. Going through the one of the points that was talked about was how it's important. One of the great things that the Energy Trust has done is they have gone after some very big projects, and those projects have served our members very well in buying down the cost of efficiency projects. But keep in mind, the Energy Trust Board feels it's very important to balance, as the resources come in, to balance between residential, commercial, and industrial investments. And that's a good thing. That's something the board has taken a long time in developing that position. However, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going after the best and most efficient and effective conservation projects for the state. So again, it's a board decision, not a commission decision, not a legislative decision to do that. So with that in mind, I would like to just follow up with what Mr. Van Cleve and Mr. Burr have said, that the trust has also increased, the public purpose charge collections have increased significantly. Based on our estimation, 2002, the first year, they collected around $40 million. And based on our estimations and their estimations for the 2007, you know, we think that's going to be about a 60% increase to over $60 million. So we don't need any legislation to increase the public purpose charge, and we don't need to grant any additional authority over to the commission to have the flexibility to move that charge up and down. One final point. I think when I spoke with many of you at the when you were in 1999 about this legislation, I have to say, when I lobbied it, I felt that, I obviously didn't do a good enough job reading the legislation. We felt that only the legislature could increase that charge, and that the commission couldn't. I was wrong. they can increase that charge for commercial and residential customers. However, we believe it's an interesting situation for the commission to be in. If they can increase it for industrials, then how could they justify increasing it for other commercial and residential customers? So that has worked to our advantage. And you might want to, it's just something that we'd rather have it that way than to have everybody moved over to commission authority.
Okay. Committee? Nothing? Thank you, the three of you. I was a little more flexible in my time with the three of you because you're the only group testifying in opposition. I wanted to make sure you had all the time you needed. Might not be quite so generous with the other two pages of folks, but I do want to make sure you have a chance to at least get to the table. John Fletcher, Jim Edelson, and Stephen Weiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Fletcher. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor for Oregon Housing and Community Services. And in the interest of time, I'll try to summarize my remarks. I have submitted written testimony that I hope you'll review also. Oregon Housing and Community Services is sort of a different animal in this whole discussion. We don't produce energy, and we don't regulate energy, and yet we're very much connected to the public purpose charges and have been from the beginning. And I don't want to cover all the reasons for that, but I will remind the committee that in considering the public purposes for which these public purpose charges were to be directed, there were quite a few possible interests that were weighed, education being one, conservation, renewable energy. But among the public purposes that were decided initially, and those public purposes exist today equally as strong, there were decisions made to allocate public purpose charges for low-income Oregonians, many of whom have a hard time paying their energy costs. Generally, a middle-income family may spend 5% of their family budget on energy costs, but a low-income family, that number may be as high as 20% of their budget. And so some low-income weatherization funds could combine with other funds that the state and federal government have that could help relieve this burden for low-income Oregonians. That was considered an important public purpose, and I think rightly so. And so in the original legislation, there was 11.7% of the funds directed for low-income weatherization, as you recall. Another important public purpose that was deemed at the original formation of the public purpose charges was for affordable housing development. And the reasons for this had to do with, I think, budget considerations at the time, that was a pressing need, but there were also energy savings advantages that occur when you build new affordable housing. More likely than not, it replaces the substandard housing conditions that people were in, and the new housing is more energy efficient. There are built-in energy efficiencies from that, as well as social benefits and state benefits, or in other words, a greater public purpose that is served as well. As you know, housing prices have increased in the last few years dramatically, even more so than energy costs. And so the affordability issue remains with us for housing, and we see that that's going to be an ongoing need. And so as we looked at the sunset of these public purpose funds, we're greatly concerned that the affordable housing piece, for example, is continued. Currently, the public purpose funds, now that they have replaced our general fund for support of the housing trust fund, that constitutes almost 100% of the housing trust fund revenue that comes in. We do make a little money off of interest, but more than 95% of the funds are coming from public purpose charges. If that were to cease, we would be hard-pressed to find ways to support our projects in the same manner as the housing trust fund does. The money that comes through the trust fund is unique. It is flexible. It can be used in a lot of ways that leverage funds and help projects get off the ground. It's very important to our partners, and I'm sure we could have a lot of people come and testify to the need of that, but I won't go into that. In short, we feel it's critical that as public purpose funds are evaluated and renewed, that we don't lose sight of these two important public purposes. We were pleased to see that in the PUC's bill, the proportions on the original 3% were maintained for housing and community services. And we're not saying as a department that the extra 2% needs to necessarily go our direction. There's certainly a need for that. There are other bills in the building circulating to provide more money for housing, and this may or may not be something that we want to do through public purpose. But the monies that have been provided are critical. We have.
I'll need you to wind it up pretty quick, too.
Okay. I appreciate your time, and again, we would like to see Senate Bill 87 or some equivalent pass that preserves those funds for Oregon Housing and Community Services for those low-income Oregonians.
Very good. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Stephen Weiss, senior policy analyst for the Northwest Energy Coalition. We're a coalition of over 100 groups. Our little yellow letterhead gives our shows the groups in our coalition. We're one of the largest organizations in the Northwest working on clean energy and low-income issues. I, too, was one of the people who helped write and negotiate 1149. You're probably going to hear from a lot of us. And I wanted to first address the one issue that was raised by Brad and Julie about its section 3.1F, which allows which in the current bill, current law, allows the commission to establish a different public purpose charge. I did write that, and that'll teach a non-lawyer to write legislation. Fully expected, and it was accepted by the coalition that supported the bill, that provided that the except for the large industrial customers that had a cap, that for everyone else it was a floor, 3% was a floor, and that the commission could raise the amount. The commission, as lawyers have since decided that is not true, that they interpreted that you could raise one, but you'd have to lower the other, lower another one to keep it under 3% total. So that is one of the reasons why we're here sponsoring this. So if I had written that maybe more clearly, we might not be here. So I apologize for that. The first point I'd like to make, though, is that the 3% level was not picked out of a hat, as it was not picked out of a political compromise. It was a result of a year-long process called a comprehensive review in 1996, done by the whole region, which looked at the council's fourth power plan, looked at the cost effectiveness, the price of power, how much conservation was out there, how much renewables was out there, and came up with the 3% level as the proper amount to capture all the cost-effective conservation. Cost-effective meaning it's cheaper than the alternative generation resource, like coal-fired power plant. Since that time, the council has done its fifth power plan, and in that fifth power plan, two things have happened. One is new technologies have come forward, reducing the price of conservation, and secondly, the price of electricity has gone up, mainly because of the natural gas prices have been spectacularly rising. That allowed the council's new target went up by 67%. So went from 1,500 megawatts to 2,500 megawatts. Secondly, in the fourth plan, renewables were sort of a fun little thing. We should do some investment and research and development. In the fifth power plan, they account for fully half of the region's load growth. It should be done with renewables. So given those two quite important changes, raising the 3% level now is consistent with the original bill and is something that should be done. Finally, although we support this bill, we support it only mostly. We are concerned that any increase in the bill does not give a share to low-income weatherization. Low-income customers are in need most of conservation. They live in substandard housing often. So we would suggest a small amendment which would ensure that the 11.7% that of any increase, 11.7% of that increase would continue to go to low-income weatherization. Thank you very much.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is James Edelson. I was a representative of the Oregon Interfaith Global Warming Campaign on Governor Kulongowski's Carbon Allocation Task Force. And in my short time, I just want to kind of demonstrate why we think this bill is an opportunity for the state, and because we think there is money on the table here and energy efficiency opportunities. And the way I want to demonstrate this is the results of the nexus between the energy efficiency spending and the global warming policy. This first chart is, graph is of the from results of the IPM modeling, which is about $700,000 worth of modeling that was done for the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and that's the 10 states in the Northeast that have formed a memorandum of understanding to limit greenhouse gas emissions in the electricity sector. And what I want to look at mostly are the top three lines, because that kind of will be close to what is you're going to see for the Oregon case also. The top line is a reference case, which is really no energy efficiency policy. The purple line is the line which is the continued efficiency policies that are already underway in the Northeast states. And what the yellow line is what they call the 2X case, which is doubling the efficiency. And this is looked at in the context of a global warming policy in for the entire region. And what you can see is that if they follow the 2X policy, that alone will pretty much hold their emissions from the electric sector even. But I just wanted to show you that as a context for the next slide, because the surprising part of this is that policy, that 2X energy efficiency policy, in this extensive modeling actually produced savings for the region and savings within each customer class and savings at two different time periods. And these are models that have been run extensively, and this is why one of the reasons this has been adopted by 10 states now, including Maryland, which has joined recently, and the state of Massachusetts, which has joined back into the region. But as you can see, somewhere between 4 and 12%, depending on the customer class, these are real savings, real bill savings, as a result of this 2X efficiency policy, which is very similar to what SB 87 will do for Oregon. So now I want to give the context from our experience on the Oregon Carbon Allocation Task Force. This is a table that was presented to us from the Energy Trust itself. And this kind of demonstrates the reason why those savings are there. When you look at the colorful rainbows, when you look at the bar graphs, you can see the achievable energy efficiency is literally about $25 a megawatt hour, averaged out over the life of the measure, because there is no fuel cost. And that's a real certain cost. There's not all the variability. Whereas coal, steam, natural gas is the most expensive, and wind, which is now very competitive, or with incentives, can be even more competitive than coal. And that's why it's going in so quickly. But as you can see, what this SB 87 will do will get us all that cheap stuff between $25 and $45 per levelized megawatt hour. And that's what this policy does. And that's what the legislature should give the flexibility to the Utility Commission to do. Because if we don't do that, it's going to stay on the table. And this is the results from Hal Nelson. He did the study for Oregon. He's from PSU. And his results, you see there's a slight fixed charge per megawatt hour of about 65 cents increase. So the rates go up. You may hear rates go up, and that is, in a sense, true. But the important thing, statewide, by raising this, the bills in Oregon go down $48 to $70 million a year. And that was studied in the context of a carbon policy, and literally it's a 2X carbon policy that we looked at in the Carbon Allocation Task Force. So to summarize, we think this SB 87 is a sound policy. It's good policy, it's good economics, it's good for the environment, and we believe that it's a moral imperative that Oregon captures these savings as soon as we can. We think you should give the flexibility to the Public Utility Commission, and it'll be good for Oregonians. Thank you. Any questions?
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. My first question was with Mr. Weiss. Am I saying that right?
Yes.
You stated that the demand has gone up 67% versus your first, where something 4 versus 5, because of whatever you said. But what you failed to mention was that the public purpose charge is already generating at least 60% more than was anticipated when you did your first study. So when you factor that in, shouldn't we 3% be doing right where you need to be? I mean, within a couple percentage points.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer. What this, yes, rates have gone up, and that has increased the charge. Rates go up, rates go down. They tend to go up more.
Rates go down.
And what this bill does, it doesn't raise the public purpose charge automatically. It allows the Public Utility Commission to have hearings and to have evidentiary hearings and decide whether there is more cost-effective conservation to be achieved. None of this money will go for a single measure that costs more than a coal plant or more than a gas plant. And if it if the commission says they should only raise it to 3.5%, then they'll only raise it to 3.5%. If the commission says it should be 4% can be used productively, then it'll go to 4%. So this does not raise it on my numbers. It will allows the commission to have a study to receive testimony from all sides and to make a decision based on the facts.
Thank you. I guess I would say that's what we're here for. And when taxes need to go up or down, I think that's what we get elected to do. And that's one of my general problems with the bill, is that, you know, that's why this panel is sitting up here, is to have people come and talk about both sides of an issue and raise it up or down. And to give that control or that power to an unelected body, I think just inappropriate. I guess on the other, Mr. Edison, you said your bills go down 40 to 70 million dollars. I defy you to find anyone who's had their electric bills go down since we've had a 3% public purpose charge on it.
No, I happened to bring my electric bill, and because we're now paying 8.43 cents a kilowatt hour, and what that means is that is. The bills are going up, and the energy efficiency and the conservation have taken my demand, which is the 250 kilowatts, and made it 230 kilowatts. And those are real savings. And so bills have gone down, even though rates may have gone up, relative to what they would have done in the absence of the Energy Trust. You can read the study by Eco Northwest. Those are the numbers, and those are irrefutable pretty much.
Mr. Chair, I guess when the public purpose charge started, one of the main premises for this 3% was that this is embedded cost in our bills. And when this was broke out and everybody would see it in their bill, the corresponding rate would go down 3%, because that's what power companies were paying for this service prior to this. I think this happened in 2002. I asked the PUC commission right after that if we would be seeing a corresponding 3% reduction in our pure rate costs, and that never happened. So I don't agree with that premise that actual power costs went down.
Mr. Chairman,
last comment, and then we'll move on to the next panel.
The choice is simple. You buy, if your demand goes up, and everybody's demand, especially businesses' demand, is going up as they grow, they're going to have to buy from a coal plant or a gas plant or efficiency. Coal plants are about 6 cents a kilowatt hour. Gas plants are probably 7 cents a kilowatt hour. And efficiency is 1 to 2 cents a kilowatt hour. So you should just do the math, and it's as simple as that. Which is more expensive? You can figure it out. Thank you.
I'll go in there.
Thanks, three of you. Appreciate your testimony very much. Troy Gagliano, Jeff Bissonette, Jeremiah Bauman.
I couldn't be more of a no now. That was not good. Bye. We're not the only folks.
ridiculous.
Whoever of you would like to begin, go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Troy Gagliano. I'm with the Renewable Northwest Project. We're a renewable energy advocacy group that serves the fourth northwestern states. We're also a member of the Renewable Energy Advisory Committee to the Energy Trust, and I just will have some brief comments here for you in support of the bill. One, as Chair Beyer showed us, Oregon's public purpose charge is a success story, and allowing the PUC to increase it as needed will save Oregonians even more money. As we've seen again through Chair Beyer, the Energy Trust is putting up some significant numbers of savings, capturing cost-effective efficiency and renewables. And also the independent review of the public purpose charge by Eco Northwest that was written for the legislature in October 2006 shows some of that. The fact is that although the trust has done a good job, there's a lot more efficiency and conservation and renewable energy to get. The Northwest Power and Conservation Council's fifth power plan determined that the region could capture about 5,000 megawatts of new cost-effective renewables and about 2,800 megawatts of cost-effective efficiency over the next 20 years. I'll skip some of the examples because, again, Chairman Beyer showed us some really good illustrations. In fact, the Energy Trust programs have been so successful that they're oversubscribed. The Trust's positive reputation continues to grow, and Oregonians, individuals, and businesses continue to want to partner with the Trust to accrue more savings through efficiency and renewables. There's simply more demand for the trust services than what the 3% will allow. And allowing the PUC to increase it, again, as they would see needed, up to 5% would enable the commission to help Oregon individuals and businesses capture even more cost-effective projects for the benefits of customers and businesses. That's all for my brief comments. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette. I'm here today representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, faith organizations, clean energy businesses, and labor organizations. And my comments will be exceedingly brief. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss the pros and cons of giving the PUC the authority to adjust the public purpose charge. We think it's an important policy issue, and we see this as kind of the start of probably not a prolonged conversation, but an important conversation. And today, one of our members, the Northwest Energy Efficiency Council, is an industry group in the Northwest with several members in Oregon representing several thousand jobs in the state that do commercial and industrial energy efficiency projects, and they wanted to be on record as supporting Senate Bill 87, and I have a letter from Stan Price, their executive director, which I'll provide to the committee, and say thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremiah Bauman, for the record, an environmental advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. In the interest of brevity, I'll skip beyond the stump speech you might usually hear me give about energy independence and global warming, and simply note that for all of the energy problems that Oregonians are increasingly concerned about, energy conservation is the cheapest and fastest way toward a solution. I'm just going to make a couple of notes about how the public purposes charge has been administered, which I think has led to the Energy Trust of Oregon becoming a popular organization among Oregonians who are in the service territories that they're allowed to serve, and also a very effective organization. My simple points are these. First, they've managed to benefit a very large number of Oregonians with the budget that they have. They, in 2005 alone, completed 180,000 energy efficiency projects, ranging from 15,000 energy efficient clothes washers to 1,800 projects for commercial energy consumers. They also include a number of renewable energy projects, including 100 solar hot water heaters and more than 100 solar electric systems. My second point is that the Energy Trust has managed to spread these benefits out among all sectors of Oregonians and those who are paying a lot in energy bills these days to make sure those benefits are spread out just as payment for them is spread out. A couple of examples beyond the thousands of individuals include the Rogue Valley Medical Center, saving $160,000 annually because of energy efficiency investments, and Blue Heron Paper Company saving more than $5 million annually because of investments in production efficiency. My last note on how the Energy Trust has administered these funds is they've done a very good job of being creative with the projects in a way that gets both major energy efficiency savings and allows for public education of Oregonians about the importance of these issues. And a good example of that is their promotion last winter, and I believe this winter as well, by offering 99-cent energy-efficient light bulbs at stores like Fred Meyer. They've managed not only to serve those people who have the wherewithal to find the investments and incentive programs that are available from various organizations, but put their products out in front of a lot of people across the state and save a lot of energy. I'll close by just noting a couple of the questions and concerns that have been raised. First, on the question of why the Commission shouldn't compel utilities to invest in energy efficiency and energy conservation rather than building a new power plant when demand is rising. I think the simplest answer is simply this is the way that the Public Utility Commission does that. Unlike a new power plant, which a utility can go out and build and operate and then sell the power from it, energy efficiency happens in thousands of different ways in everybody's lives through things like clothes washers and changing manufacturing processes. The utility is not necessarily in the best position to be making those investment choices. What the commission can do is compel the utilities to fund those choices and have those administered by someone like the Energy Trust who's in a position to do those investments in an efficient way. Second, while it's true that Energy Trust's funding has increased, that is because we're using more energy and energy is getting more expensive, which means the need for energy efficiency and conservation has increased proportionally, and those dollars are not going any farther proportionally than they were going when this program was started. With that, I'll close and see what questions the panel has.
Are you?
No.
All right. Thanks for your brevity.
Thank you.
And your testimony. Jeremy Anderson, Mary Mann, and Jerry Page.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for letting me come. My name is Jerry Page. I have a weatherization company here in Salem that I've been running for a little over three decades, and we specialize in conservation on existing or retrofit weatherization. I'm also president of a new trade association called WISE that I'll talk about very briefly. We're here to be in support of Senate Bill 87, and I would just like to take a little bit. We kind of represent that last tier of conservation that the commissioner was talking about. And just to give you a little bit of understanding how important the cash incentives are, both for all the hundreds of small businesses throughout the state and the local industry, such as Empire Windows, LBL, Milgarden, et cetera, and to many hundreds of employees. I just want to explain how the system works. You probably know that if a homeowner wants to do an item such as a blower door test, they get a $50 rebate. They want to insulate their attic, they get a $250 rebate, and so on. Worked with Fred Gordon of the Energy Trust to kind of put together just a typical house to explain what the savings are. By and large, the largest number of people who contact our company and most others are interested in windows. So we go out and we say, well, we sell windows, and here it is. But, you know, while I'm here, let me look in your attic. Let me look at your ducts. And we explain and say, okay, now if you want to do your windows, they're going to cost you $4,000. But you don't get rebates, so let's talk about sealing your ducts or doing air seeing on the house and doing the test. And without going through all the steps and the brevity of time, instead of spending $4,000, we want you to spend $8,500. When they look at you and you've heard about how important the energy dollars are, I'm sure that's not a surprise. They say, what are you, nuts? Well, the importance of cash incentives from the Energy Trust is it allows us to bundle and to put things together. And so right off the bat, say, well, if you're going to spend $4,000 on windows, you don't get any rebates. But if you'll do another two majors, you'll get a $360 rebate. But let's go through this, and we do it line by line by line. If you deduct or add up the window incentives of about $360. If you add up the air sealing, the duct sealing, insulation cash rebates, you're eligible for about $1,600. If you add the state tax credit for duct sealing and the federal income tax credit of $500, we've got total incentives bundled together of about $2,700. So you are going to spend $4,000 for windows. For another $1,800, you can have your whole house weatherized. Well, people pay attention to that, and that's our sales. And so what does it mean to the state? It means window savings on a 1,300, you know, ranch-style house are about 560 kilowatts. When we bundle all the savings, you get an average of about 5,000 kilowatts. So it's enough. It tips a lot of people in favor to do a complete weatherization job on their house instead of doing it piecemeal. And then if it happens to be a rental occupancy, then they bundle that with the 35% State of Oregon BETSI tax credit or the 30% pass-through, and it becomes a pretty important package to those folks. I just want to make it real clear that, you know, they get $250 maybe to do an attic or a floor. It isn't much. When they reduced it from $300 to $250, you can see a noticeable lag. So these cash incentives are very, very key to acquiring energy savings.
To summarize, because we have four more people to testify, and we will be ending at 4:30. So
okay, right here. Back in the 70s, when weatherization first hit the legislature, I was just starting in business. 1978, a trade association was formed because of the good intentions just weren't quite jiving with that. Literally until 1991, the weatherization industry struggled to do all the programs. So I just want to thank this committee, the PUC, Department of Energy, the Energy Trust, for allowing us to get involved at this early stage, because I think we have a lot of valuable input that will make these programs work better.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Akfin and fellow committee members, my name is Mary Mann. I own Goose Hollow Window Company. I'm a general contractor. 5215 Childs Road, Lake Oswego. This is the beginning of my 27th year in the weatherization industry, and I have certainly seen the ups and downs of when these programs go up and then they come down. And I cannot tell you how important it is to keep these monies coming. And we're at a kind of a little hill here where we really need some more money. And I know I got the Energy Trust Award for having sold the most multifamily projects in the state of Oregon. Those projects are bridge those gaps between the low income we're talking about from the gentleman behind us to the people that have some money, and all those people have the opportunity to become homeowners. With the Energy Trust's involvement in these multifamily projects, I'm seeing people that have been spending $200 a month on heating spend $100 a month after we put in insulation, windows, and doors. Without the cooperation of the Energy Trust and the business energy tax credits, with the property managers and the owners, these things aren't going to happen, and these people have no control. We're taking 3% of the ratepayers' money of these tenants that have no control whatsoever of who's going to give them the benefit of getting their money back. So the only way to do this is to give the incentive to the investor, who has no incentive because he doesn't pay the heat bill. And his property values are rising, and so all he has to do, or she has to do, is make money is sell. But they'll still be selling an uninsulated unit with tenants who don't have any control of their heat bills. When these properties start to weatherize, they start to ping pong. One unit starts to go, one apartment complex. All of a sudden, people go from this type of apartment complex, and they say, well, I'm going to pay a little bit more for my rent, but gee, I'm cutting my heat bills in half. This starts to make attention. So we have the attention right now of the property managers and the owners, but we have a real problem. We've had 5 years of depressed rent increases. We can't raise these rents to help the owners cover the cost of doing these projects. So we have a real bind here, and we have a momentum that's being fueled by the federal government, by the international market, with what China's doing with taking our natural resources, increasing our cost of materials and goods and services. It's not just Oregon. We're competing on a world scale here, and we need to address that and be competitive. And we've got the means to do it. It's proven. For 30 years, we know conservation works, and this works.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Jeremy Anderson. I represent WISE, which is the group of weatherization and HVAC contractors to which Mr. Page earlier referred. You have my written testimony, so I won't repeat it. I'll just add that the Energy Trust and Public Purpose Charge programs are very important, both to the large number of small and large businesses that work through it, and more importantly, to the homeowners who can, on average, according to the Department of Energy, save at least 30% on their energy bills. And that they cannot do without this help. This is a very, very important program. Thank you.
Good. Thanks very much for your testimony. I appreciate you making the drive to get here. It's helpful to the committee. Paul Hurley, Mark Gagling, and Chris Ware. Mark, did I not get your name right?
You're close.
Close. Why don't you go ahead first, then Mark, then we'll know. And Matt, if you don't mind, would you bring me up the other sign-up sheet?
Mr. Chair and the rest of the committee, I'm Mark Gagle with Gagle's Heating and Air Conditioning. I've been in this community since 1966 doing heating and air conditioning. I am in favor of Senate Bill 87 because I deal with the consumer every day. We're all consumers. All the consumers that we deal with, as you stated, Senator Beyer, I have never seen utility rates go down. It doesn't happen. The big businesses are going to make their money. That's going to happen. What we can do, or what this Senate bill is hopefully going to do, everybody has a heightened awareness of what they're paying for energy, whether it's fuel for their car, heat for their house, air conditioning in the summer. It's still a reality. If we can give incentives to go to the most energy efficient equipment available to us at this time, then it's a good thing. Thank you.
Yeah, my name's Paul Curley. Actually, I'm an end user, and I'm kind of curious. I seem to be the only one here testifying. I'm a landlord who owns, I seem to have acquired over the last 25 years, a number of 1970s vintage residential rentals, apartments, houses, and this kind of thing. And I'm tired of being called a slum landlord, so I wanted to upgrade my projects, and I contacted with Jerry Page of Total Comfort, who just testified, and he was telling me that, hey, Paul, with the energy tax savings, I can save you 50% if you weatherize your units. And then with the Department of Energy financing the other half, you can upgrade your properties. And I was willing to do that, but you have to understand, as a landlord, I don't, and I'm not going to be popular by saying this, but I don't care about weatherization. I don't pay it. The tenant pays the utility bills. They pay for the heat. I've got other problems in these units. I'm having to replace carpets. A 30-year-old building, the stoves are going out, the refrigerators are going out, the dishwashers are going out. Of course, the roof is leaking. And talk about stopped-up toilets and this kind of thing. Weatherization is not high on my list. But with the incentives that you folks give, I felt paying for half of it, I was willing to do that. Because it does pay back indirectly. I get happier tenants. They stay longer. They're willing to pay a little more rent, which is a nice touch. And they don't tear up the place. But if I could push you a little bit, the 50% that you guys were willing to help me with pushed me over the hump. But we replaced, 1,000 windows? So I feel like I've got a little experience by putting in 1,000 windows. And what Jerry doesn't know is some of the units that I want to put windows in, I'm pulling back, because when you're doing this weatherization to older projects, it's turned into a construction project. The weatherization has deteriorated into bigger problems than I knew that I had. For example, you
give me just one or two examples, because we've got about 2 minutes and one more person to testify.
You replace the bathroom window in the bathroom. You open it up, you find dry rot that seeps through everything. It's open. You got to replace it now. I've replaced whole bathrooms. They go into some of the dry rot spread into other bedrooms. It's turned into a major construction project. So if I could push you to consider even more than 50%, you'd have my blessing.
Thank you. Well, we started with you, sort of, and we're finishing with you, but go right ahead.
No problem. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Chris Ware. I'm a territory manager at Empire Pacific Windows in Tualatin. We're a manufacturer of vinyl windows, employing roughly 230 persons. And our products are geared towards the residential market, both single-family and multifamily units. And haven't done any specific research as far as numbers on this, but I have witnessed personally a direct correlation between the availability of incentive programs for replacing windows and the number of windows that we sell on an annual basis. And I guess it's somewhat of a self-serving testimony here that with these programs I can sell more windows. But it is good for Oregon business, businesses that are directly related to manufacturing products that go into conservation programs. And we can see definitely more employment in our business as we sell more products for those purposes. That's about it. So we definitely support.
Very good. I appreciate the three of you coming. You didn't talk very long, but it was very valuable for the committee, so thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 87, and I'm going to carry over Senate Bill 232. And, Mr. Graney, if you don't mind stopping by the dais before you go. And with that, we are adjourned.